Welcome to the Numbers and Narrative Podcast. This is your co-host, Joe Flood. This week, Rennie McPherson was in New York City speaking with Christy Reardon, the COO of the Flatiron School, which turns amateurs into software engineering professionals with just a few months of rigorous training. The best statistic? Grads have a 98% placement rate into jobs. Rennie and Christy talk about Christy's path to Flatiron, software engineering as a second career, and one of our favorite topics, the advantage of engineers who come from diverse backgrounds with more varied professional and educational experiences. And don't forget to tune in next week when I'll be interviewing naval historian Stephen Ujifusa about his Wall Street Journal Top Book of the Year, A Man and His Ship, a new book he's working on about Yankee Clipper ships, and some historical numbers, as Steve tells us about the transportation and communication revolutions of the seas. Over to you, Rennie.
Welcome to the Numbers and Narrative Podcast. This is your co-host, Rennie McPherson. I'm here at the Flatiron School with the COO of Flatiron School, Christy Reardon. Welcome, Christy.
Hi, Rennie. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. First, I have to say that since the last time I visited you at Flatiron School, only several months ago, it has expanded greatly. We're in a room that there may be some acoustic interruptions as you guys are just growing.
Often is the case.
Growing, literally. Can you tell us what is Flatiron School and what does it do?
Sure. So Flatiron School is our vision and our mission at Flatiron School is to align education with reality, which is a pretty big mission. And I think it will actually take us a long time to make that happen. But what that means today is that we have created accessible education to help people develop technical skills that are highly valued in the marketplace. In our adult program, it's designed for primarily career changers, people who are most commonly about 25 to 45 years of age. They've previously had a career. And they're either unhappy with it or have discovered that they have this love for coding and want to build software. But they don't want to go back and pursue a four-year education, and in fact, they don't need to. So our programs are designed to be able to give them the skills that they need for an entry-level software engineering job in just about 12 weeks. They work really hard, though. They put in about 750 to 850 hours of work with a little bit of pre-work and then a lot of that on our campus during that 12-week
period. That sounds like a lot of hours per week. I'm trying to do the mental math.
It's a lot of hours per week. So they spend about 150 hours with pre-work before they ever get here.
Okay.
And then once they're on campus, they are here. They are fully in this program. They're usually here with our teaching staff from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. formally, but they're also spending later nights and they're spending weekends. And it's when I mentioned that this is a more accessible program, for many people, they can't be without a job for 2 years or 3 years or 4 years. And so it's accessible because of the way in which we teach students, but also because it's a 12-week long program. And so they can get back out into the market and pursue a job. Our placement rates are actually 98% job placement within 90 days, and it's an average starting salary of $75,000.
Wow, that is really quite something. And I think as many people, you know, kind of look at software developers as, oh, I couldn't do that. It's really heartening to hear that for people 25 to 45, they can, with really, really hard work for a, you know, 3 month period plus the pre-work, reinvent themselves with a 98% success rate. So that's wonderful to hear in and of itself. I would be curious as more and more of them graduate, this layer of software developers who have had previous experience in life, so they didn't just go into that career field immediately, what the sort of feedback on their ability to put software development in a greater context of business would be.
One of the things that I'm most excited about at Flatiron School is the diversity of candidates that come into our programs and go out into the marketplace. I think, you know, many people are probably aware of the diversity challenge that exists within the tech industry today. And when I mentioned that our programs are accessible, it's accessible not only because you don't have to pursue a computer science degree, but we create just a very different learning environment, an environment that is welcoming and intentionally available for a lot of different types of people. So we oftentimes talk about building a class and admitting a class rather than individual students. So we look for having diversity of perspective. Diversity of perspective can be all sorts of things beyond the types of things that we might be accustomed to in terms of gender, race, ethnicity. We look for people who have different types of backgrounds. So many of our students have completely different backgrounds from not just, you know, a place like investment banking, but we've had former professional baseball players. We have a lot of musicians and artists, people who come out of a lot of different careers. And what's interesting about that for the workforce and for our hiring partners who hire our graduates is that they have a greater opportunity to find a fit for their organization. For example, if you are a company who's selling retail, you may be very interested in finding somebody who's passionate about fashion. We have employers who come to us who, the New York Times is one of our hiring partners, and they have oftentimes hired people who might have formerly been an English major. That's not the typical graduate who's coming up through a traditional computer science program. So I think that diversity of perspective is important because it changes the way in which teams are able to collaborate. It also changes the way in which software engineers understand the underlying product of the business and the customers that they're trying to sell to. And over time, it allows the software engineer to add incremental value to the business beyond just coding and building that software.
That, I mean, it makes so much sense hearing you say it like that. What year did Flatiron School begin?
It was the fall of 2012.
Fall of 2012, so pretty recently.
About 2.5 years.
2.5 years in. And when it started, was it aimed mostly at kind of people who had finished high school or just finished college as kind of a coding finishing school, or was it always directed at, you know, you had called it the adult program and the kind of, you know, younger student program? Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it, like any business, it's a little bit organic. So I can share some context on the founder's story. Avi Flambaum was the founder of Flatiron School and had been a CTO for a number of years, and he decided he wanted to take a break from coding and was invited to teach on a new startup business in New York City called Skillshare. Many people may be familiar with Skillshare. His friend was founding the company, and he said, well, I could try to teach people Ruby on Rails. Maybe people would be interested in learning this. And so he began doing that and was just marketing out to his network and through some of Skillshare's networks. It became the single most popular course that was offered here in New York City on the Skillshare platform. And what he found while doing this is that there was always a certain segment of people who signed up for the course that was just a part-time nights and weekends course that were very serious about it, and they loved it, and they were coming to find him after hours and were asking him questions, and they were going the extra mile, and they were really able to learn enough skills that over the course of working with him over a year, he felt like they were ready to actually go take on some project work. And so he began connecting them to people in his network who were having a hard time finding developers,
right,
and said, listen, I think I can work with these individuals, and we can build a small project for you, a small website back in like this. And so that's actually how this idea began to emerge, is that there was this sort of self-selecting group of individuals who were so committed and interested in doing this, were unhappy with the careers that they already had. Then comes along the other co-founder of Flatiron School, Adam Enbar, who was working at a venture capital firm trying to invest in education. He had been looking at a lot of ed tech companies and really felt like the way in which many people were approaching education were creating radical efficiencies in a fundamentally flawed system. No one was really looking at the overall education system holistically and trying to recreate it. They were creating these efficiencies in slivers of the system. Mm-hmm. And so he heard about what Avi was doing over on Skillshare and invited him out for a coffee, started talking to him, and he said, listen, you've reinvented the way in which people are being educated and connecting with the market.
Right.
So he said, let's start a school. And so they did, and the first class was very similar to what it is that we do today in our adult program. It was a little bit smaller. I think there were about 20 students, but their personal network happened to be these people who already realized they had an interest in this. Most of them had some type of college education or a college degree. They wanted to change careers, and they were just really committed to learning this craft.
Like you said, it's very organic.
Very organic
story, and a lot of directions Avi could have gone with these, you know, Ruby on Rails students from Skillshare. Could start a little consulting company or something of that sort, but this is doing so much more this school.
It's doing so much more. And when we first started talking, Rennie, I was mentioning that we think of our education as creating additional access for students to learn technical education, and that many businesses, I think, can be successful if they allow themselves to grow organically based on what their customers are asking of them. And that's the newest area in our business that has developed over the last year is teaching high school students. And that's actually driving a lot of our growth right now. About a year and a half ago, so the school had been around for probably 6 to 12 months, people in the tech community started finding out what we were doing. And many tech leaders have high school students themselves.
Right.
And they asked us if we could teach them. I mean, we said, this curriculum is really rigorous.
Yeah.
This is professional grade curriculum.
They may not be able to handle it.
They may not be able to handle it. And we kept getting asked. And so finally, we experimented with this very small class. We taught about, I think we taught about 20 kids in the summer of 2013. And much to our excitement, we discovered that they were wholly capable of it. In fact, if you think about digital natives, they're oftentimes faster at picking up this curriculum than if you're talking about somebody who's 35, because they're just so used to it. They're so accustomed to it. And so in the summer of 2014, we decided to do a little bit more. We actually taught about 100 students last summer, and we spent a little bit of time learning that a student who is 13 to 18 needs to have a slightly different classroom environment and slightly different curriculum than an adult who's 25 to 45. So we modified it a little bit, but we're still teaching the same real tools, the professional software tools. So they're still learning the same curriculum. We just make it a little bit more fun.
Right.
And they like crepes and pizza. So we also give them crepes and pizza.
Crepes and pizza.
Crepes
okay.
and pizza. That's
yeah.
the secret sauce
yeah.
I've decided for engaging high school students. But we do 2-week camps,
mm-hmm.
and we teach them how to build and deploy their own app.
My gosh.
Within
yeah.
2 weeks.
Yeah.
And they're so excited about it. We had this one girl who actually was really into fashion, and she decided that she was going to do an API from a weather database. And she created pictures of clothes from her closet, and it would send her a text message every morning of which things she should wear based on what the weather was for the day.
Wow. Wow. That is incredible. And just to be able to have that outfit picked out for you is, you know, probably saves her 20 minutes a morning.
Easily. Her mother's very happy because they don't have battles anymore getting to school.
Sure.
But this summer we're going to be in 11 cities, so it's been really, a really exciting growth.
Flatiron School will be in 11 cities?
Okay. For the pre-college program.
For the pre-college program. And Flatiron School right now, we're in Lower Manhattan, you know, right near the bowl of Wall Street. Iconic in Lower Manhattan, but is this the only campus of kind of this size, or are you thinking of expanding?
For the adult program, this is the only campus here in Manhattan, with the exception of a program that is fully funded by New York City. It's called the Web Development Fellowship. It's a really, really exciting program, and that is on a campus in Brooklyn. It's the identical program to what we teach to adults here, except it's available for eligible New York City residents, and New York City pays for it. It's a really neat program. But it's the same curriculum. But our adult programs are only here in New York City.
Mm-hmm. And will be for the foreseeable future, or we'll see?
Will be for the foreseeable future.
Okay, okay. And can you explain how do these programs in these 11 other cities work for the high school students? Is that Flatiron School-trained teachers who go in and...
Sure. So this is a really interesting problem and opportunity in the broader market right now. So if you're familiar with some of the changes that are taking place in high school or even K-12 curriculum right now, it's one of the most seismic shifts I think we've seen in more than 100 years. We haven't really added a curriculum domain to our K-12 curriculum for probably 100 years. And right now that's happening with computer science education. The city of Chicago, the city of London, the state of Arkansas has mandated that CS curriculum will be taught in public school systems.
Incredible.
So there is a major shift that's taking place right now with a recognition of how important these skills are for making our students literate in a digital world. Whether they want to pursue a career in software engineering or not, it's becoming a fundamental literacy to be highly effective in any career that you want to pursue. So this is taking place. However, there is a complete lack of teachers and curriculum that is available to actually bring this to market in our school systems. So there's a lot of things that are changing right now. People are very eager in figuring out how to bring this into the school systems, and a lot of people are trying to solve this problem as we speak. So what we've done, we have a core team of teachers in our pre-college program, and we've partnered with Teach for America, and worked with them earlier this year to reach out to current teaching staff and alumni to identify teachers who would like to be trained on our curriculum. And this summer is really, really exciting. We have a pair teaching model where we put two teachers in a classroom with up to 25 high school students. And we've spent a lot of time being very thoughtful about what those pairings look like so that their expertise and their background can really complement each other. And as much as possible, we have tried to pair people who have traditional high school classroom experience with people who have deeper technical experience.
Right.
So that they can help each other manage the classroom effectively and address the technical skills. All of the teachers, we've got about 45 teachers who are out in the markets this summer in all of those cities. All of those teachers have gone through pre-work programs, similar but different to what we do with our adult students. Whether they have a technical background or a non-technical background, they've all gone through that pre-work. And they all go through an in-person boot camp experience on-site with our full-time teaching staff as well to focus on going through practice teaching sessions as well as the curriculum to make sure that they are really prepared to create an exceptional in-classroom experience for students this summer.
That is really interesting just to hear. I mean, if you think about it, like you said, computer science being a core discipline within K-12 education, the requirement for teachers to teach that is just massive. And those people who do have that skill set or ability probably could have, you know, like many teachers have their pick of a number of other options. So that's a
Absolutely.
Really important...
One of our teachers, really interesting story, she was a developer out of undergrad. I think she might have been a traditional engineering graduate. And she wanted to teach. I think she developed for a year, and she felt like something was missing. And so she actually went into the TFA Corps down in New Orleans, and she taught down there for 2 years. And now she's leaving the Corps, and so we put her through our program, and she's going to be teaching students this summer. She's going back to Chicago, which is her hometown, mm-hmm. and she's now trying to decide what she wants to do after our program. And so similar to what we were talking about earlier, that sometimes businesses need to be allowed to grow organically.
Right.
We don't know what is going to happen this fall. We've got all these teachers, and we've got this curriculum. We have our own learning management system that it's being taught on. And we're really eager to talk to the teachers midsummer about what they might be interested in doing this fall. We've got teachers who are going to be going back to Phoenix. We've got teachers who are going to be in Miami and Seattle. And they may want to go back to their home schools and bring this curriculum and the software and teach an after-school program. Or there may be an administrator where they want to integrate it into the day. So we're eager to actually find out what these teachers have as ideas on how they can take it back into their community.
Right. And I'd love to understand very briefly the actual business of Flatiron School, as I understand it, is the students pay tuition, or perhaps there's financial aid is in the other one that you mentioned in Brooklyn. Students pay tuition. Company partners who want to hire people probably also paying Flatiron School. I mean, it's a very nice marketplace. It's a very nice, you're in the middle getting paid on both sides, plus you're doing something good for the world. You can wake up every morning and think you're doing something good. Is that the nature of the business? I mean, there's so many elements here. Can you talk a bit about the business model of Flatiron School?
Sure. So we'll separate a couple of these things. Let's talk about the business model a little bit, and then I want to talk about commercial versus mission-driven, which is something that we do talk about a fair bit.
Right.
So on the business, you mentioned that there's two sides of this business, and thinking about it as a marketplace, we've got the students as the consumer of the education experience, and then you've got the employers who are hiring these graduates, and you might traditionally think of that as a recruiting service where people would pay a recruiter to actually find a student. So that is the potential monetization of that marketplace. What we have done at Flatiron School is been 100% focused on outcomes for our students. We have always felt that if we had an education product where we delivered an exceptional outcome for our students in the marketplace, meaning they were able to find a job that they were so excited about and passionate about, and the compensation of it matched their needs and their expectations, that was success. What that means is we have a number of different relationships with employers in the market. Sometimes we might be working with a large corporation like the New York Times, who would expect to have a number of relationships with recruitment firms, and they would be paying for placement services. But we also have a number of hiring partners that are early stage startups where they don't have that kind of expectation that they would pay for a service.
Right.
So we always lead at Flatiron School with the expectation of serving our hiring partners and serving our students and making sure that we have the right match for a job between a student and an employer. That doesn't mean we always get paid. We do have a fairly sizable team that works on this, on developing relationships with employers and coaching students and understanding what those students' needs are and making sure that we can find really good matches so that we have an employee who's effective and happy and successful for the employer.
Right, right.
So we don't really look at that as a revenue stream. We might be able to cover our costs on the services that we have to deploy on that. But then the students do pay tuition to access the school. So that's sort of on the business side, and the pre-college program is for a two-week camp. It's about a $2,000 camp at most of the locations around the country.
Okay.
The mission versus commercially driven is an interesting point, though. I think there's also a change that is taking place in the corporate environment today that didn't exist when we started our careers probably 15 years ago.
Right.
Where people are much, young professionals are much more mindful of having a purpose-driven career than was the case probably 15, 20, certainly 30 years ago. So we have an interesting opportunity at Flatiron School in that we are both a mission-driven organization and a commercially driven organization. And I think it's a really special place to be. We do have some folks who have joined us from nonprofits and foundations and feel that very much so, and we have other people who have joined us from more traditional corporate environments. And I think that perspective, again, that diversity of perspective creates a richness in the fabric of your organization, and I think we're able to help each other recognize the specialness of having both mission-driven and commercially driven company, in that many people who come from a foundation environment or a nonprofit environment where it's only mission-driven have limited resources available to them, which limits the impact that they can make on the particular mission that they care about. And in fact, I think that's why many people end up leaving government or leaving a nonprofit or leaving a foundation, is because they feel like their ability to impact that particular mission is limited. When you're in a high growth company, you are limited in some ways by your ability to focus and strategize and hire exceptional talent. And anybody who wants to move really quickly is usually given fuel to move even faster. So I think that's an exciting thing for people who have been historically only mission-driven, being able to be in an environment where they have the fuel from that commercially driven organization as well. And then those folks who have come out of an only a corporate-oriented commercial organization love having that feeling of true purpose in what it is that they're doing.
Right. No, it's a wonderful combination of those two sides, and you know, having the fuel to enable the mission-driven side too is wonderful. I'd love to hear more about kind of how you got to this role, which seems to match really well with your talents and experience and interests. You know, could you help paint a picture of yourself as a kid and through high school, and then maybe do a quick tour of your career?
Sure. That's a lot of history. You know, I think a lot of times people mention the entrepreneurial aspect of, you know, being at a startup, and do people have roots in that sort of startup mentality? My father was a small business owner, and I think that it's funny, nobody talked about startups in the late 70s and the early 80s, but there were a lot of small business owners, and I think a lot of the mentality of what is necessary to be effective and even really thrive and enjoy being in a startup is analogous to small business owners. So, you know, if it's your business, then you have to own everything. You are not the physical ownership, but you have to be accountable for everything.
Yes.
You have to make sure that your customers are well served. You have to make sure that you can meet payroll every month. You have to make sure that your employees are happy and engaged, because that will make your customers happy and engaged. You have to understand what is the product that we should be offering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my dad had a business that it was actually an automotive business. He did auto body repair work. And that doesn't seem analogous at all to the tech industry. But I remember my dad talking about how somebody wanted to do old car repairs, like sort of, you know, Model T cars and things that were sort of tinkering cars. And he's like, it's not a good business. It's not a good business because the margins are low and there aren't a lot of people that have those. So if you get known for being that kind of a shop, you're a specialty shop and you can't, we're in a small community in Iowa. And so we won't be able to serve the community. And we need to have those relationships where people bring us their business. And so you have referrals. So even though it was a business that was wholly unrelated at first glance to everything that I'm doing today, those fundamental concepts of treating your employees right, making sure you get them paid on time, and you're balancing your books, and you're paying attention to the customer, and you're having the customer lead your business, those are fundamental concepts that transfer to any kind of a growth organization. So I think that a lot of, you know, what I saw growing up just has always led me to wanting to be in agile environments, and nimble environments. And I was never one for, even though I've worked in some larger organizations, I was never one for big bureaucratic environments, and really like being in a very nimble and agile environment.
Yeah, that makes a little sense. That makes a lot of sense. And can you talk a bit about some of the, you know, larger places at which you worked along the way? And I think, you know, and then the organization you came from last, which was a you know, entrepreneurial business unit within an entrepreneurial larger company.
So I actually started my career at KPMG, which is one of the top, I think it's probably four now, public accounting firms, and much more than a public accounting firm. But it was a very big organization. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about at Flatiron School as a value is find what to love. And it's fundamentally important in learning, because I think so oftentimes you pass through these moments, whether it's your career, whether it's your education, even if it's your personal life. So much of what you can do is a deliberate choice. And there's usually always something to love about what it is that you're doing, especially if you can figure out what it is to enjoy and you're adding to your overall skill set. And I share that because when I was at KPMG, I hated being a public accountant. I really didn't enjoy the work. I had studied accounting in undergrad, and I knew that I didn't like the work probably in the first 30 days that I joined the firm. So pretty early on. However, I was learning so much about how a business was being run. I was 21 years old, and I was interacting with senior executives because I was on an audit for their company.
Right.
And I really took this perspective of, I'm learning so much so quickly that I think our core fundamental skills that will make me a more effective business professional, that I made the commitment to stick with it for 2 years, which I did. And you also need to work for 2 years to get your license. And I think I literally quit within 30 days after getting my license.
Yeah, but you did it.
But I did it. I did it. And I think there are moments like that throughout your career of you're not going to be happy with something that you're doing. Something is hard. It's difficult. But there's always something to love about it. And I think that's a deliberate choice to be made.
Right, right. And then, you know, are there any aspects of your job just prior to Flatiron that have kind of enabled you to, do the so many, wear all the different hats that you have to here?
So many things. So I was at GLG for about 9 years. Mm-hmm. And in that, over the course of that time, the company grew a lot. It grew from about, I think I was about the 60th employee, 60 or 70th employee, and we had 1,000 employees by the time that I left. And there is nothing like being in a growth organization.
Yeah.
If you are an individual who has a curiosity for life and learning, you will learn so much.
Absolutely.
When you're in a growth organization. And I think similar to what we were talking about earlier about allowing a business to grow a little bit organically, I think the same can be true of your career as well. And while I was at GLG, my career grew a lot organically. And in fact, I didn't even realize it until at some point in time I had a number of people coming up to me saying, how did you do this with your career? And I didn't even realize that I had actually done it.
Yeah.
Because I came in a fairly traditional customer service practice role. I actually came in to help build out an accounting and financial analysis practice, which was a core part of the business at the time. And over time, I was asked to launch and lead our first digital product, and which was new to me. I had never worked with engineers before. I had never done product management before. But because I had gained the trust of some of the leadership of the organization, they asked me to work on it. And I had an enormous learning curve with all of that. But that sort of led me down this path of beginning to launch new products and new services and enter new markets at the company.
Right.
And over the course of doing that, I got exposed to learning how to do sales, learning how to do partnership development, learning how to do marketing. So all these wonderful skills that I ultimately acquired because I organically pursued these different avenues within the firm where value needed to be created, and I just went after it. What connected me to Flatiron School toward the last year of my time at Gerson Lehrman Group was that I was actually trying to build this new business to serve technical leaders at Fortune 500 companies, chief information officers and chief technology officers.
Mm-hmm.
The company, we had gotten a little bit bigger. I missed being in that more nimble environment. And I was getting so close to technology and I was learning so much about technology that it really occurred to me how rapidly skills acquisition needed to be moving and wasn't moving. I was having all these conversations with these technical leaders and saw that their skill set was becoming obsolete. They needed to refresh their own skill sets more rapidly than they were doing. Some people were doing it, many people weren't doing it. And I found that other areas of the business, like chief marketing officers or heads of HR, and especially as digital natives were rising up in the organization and becoming mid-level to senior-level leaders, they were so much more comfortable with technology. And as we were moving to cloud-based implementations rather than large-scale enterprise implementations, they didn't need the IT department anymore.
Sure.
They just were moving faster than they were. And so this realization just sort of hit me that I wanted to be closer to technology. I wanted to get back to an earlier stage organization and do more of the building again. And I still loved being in a learning environment. And so finding Flatiron was sort of special because it really encompasses all of those things.
Yeah, it certainly does, and I feel like it matches all of the, you know, things on your list. And you know, I think as you said, at various parts of anyone's career, whether it's after those first couple of years getting a skill together, or you know, you put your head up and kind of the middle of your career and realize, wow, I have this track record, but what I really want is, and you know, you kind of write down some of the things you're really looking for. It sounds like it matches all of those things. When did you actually come to Flatiron School?
I joined at the beginning of 2014.
Okay, so about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what, I think I last visited maybe early to mid 2014, but what, when you arrive in this new environment, you know, it's still pretty small, but, you know, potentially, I would say now you're a very high-growth company. Then it was, you are about to be a very high-growth company. How did you think about what to focus on when you first came?
Yeah, so I think about a few things. The first thing, and I think this is true for anyone starting in a company, regardless of if you have perfect clarity on your role or, you know, complete ambiguity, you want to find a way to add value as soon as possible. So I remember, I think I was here my first week, and I was actually buying health insurance for the company.
Huh.
We only had, I think, about 5 or 10 employees from the prior year. So we had a very small health insurance plan, and it was about to expire, and we needed a new plan. So that's the first thing, is just find there's always an opportunity to add value and figure out what's not being done. And it doesn't matter if it's above or below your pay grade, just take it on and add value. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is it's really, really important to build trust in a new environment. And so I was looking for ways in which I could build trust with people. I think that's a lot about asking questions and listening and being super responsive. I remember someone was trying to purchase a house at the time and needed payroll records and was having difficulty with ADP. And I just was super, I went over and above trying to be responsive to that individual. It's a high-stress situation that somebody's in. And I think they were sort of surprised that I was just really responsive. And it's a simple thing to do, but that's a part of building trust. So those are some of the two things that I think about when I first enter into an organization, is trying to figure out how can you immediately add value before you figure out what you're going to be doing, and how do you build trust with employees. And then I guess the last thing is, especially entering into a newly created role in a relatively nascent organization, at a senior level, nobody's going to define your job for you. So you're going to have to do it.
Right.
So I think that's the other thing that I was, while I was trying to actively add value in whatever way I could, I was simultaneously trying to figure out what are the biggest needs within the organization And when you're a small organization that runs the gamut of high-level strategic issues all the way down to do we have enough garbage cans to collect all the garbage that's building up on the campus? So it's you know, doing, again, a lot of question asking, a lot of listening, and then quickly trying to assess these are the immediate priorities that we need to do, and these are the little bit longer-term priorities, and just starting to ruthlessly prioritize mm-hmm. because there's always more to be done than can actually be done.
There's always more to be done. And, I mean, I think it's really interesting, like you said, when you're coming in a senior role of a fairly new company, nobody really has time to tell you what you should be doing, which I think is something good for everyone to know. A unique thing about Flatiron School, which is certainly not the case for many high-growth tech companies, is not only did you have to, you know, kind of figure out internally managing some of the people, the processes down to the mundane, and also be able to go to, you know, high-level meetings with, you know, potential partner companies or whatever else, but unlike most tech companies, you guys also had to have a sort of maybe facade of you all knew exactly what was going on because you had students. You have students here now, many of them, who are looking to you guys as, oh, yeah, you're our educator, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, was that one more kind of part of the balancing act was you were also in the midst of running a school with people who were actually coming into your, you know, workspace of your startup every day to expecting to, you know, have classes in software development?
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's actually something that's popped up a little bit because we do hire out of our own education programs. We love to hire out of our education programs, in fact, because we think they make fantastic employees. but it's interesting seeing people sort of bridge that divide of being a student and becoming an employee. So we sort of get a feel for what that's been like for a student. But I think the first thing that we always have to keep in mind is making sure that we are providing exceptional service to the students in the education product that we're delivering. One of the things that we began to implement pretty quickly last year was a survey to our students. I mean, it's a pretty simple thing, but sometimes the most simple things are the best things. And we figured out what kind of questions do we need to be asking. We were asking everything from the specific curriculum and where they felt like they were prepared to the actual experience of being on the campus. And that led us to realize we needed to do some renovations on the campus. Mm. We needed to create some better physical a better physical experience for the students in certain aspects because they're spending a lot of time here. It's not like a classroom where they're going in for 3 to 9 hours a week. They're spending 60 hours a week here, maybe more.
Yeah, it's not only their classroom in a kind of traditional sense, but it's also kind of their home. They're doing their homework here.
That's right. They're even here on the weekends and getting tutored by some of our alumni. And so they invest a lot while they're here. So I think the first point is that we didn't lose sight of the fact that the people we were really serving were our students. And so we really tried to stay focused on making sure that we had an exceptional education product for the students that was valued by the employers. But we did have a lot of activity that was going on that wasn't necessarily related to what the faculty was doing in teaching the students every day. And in the beginning, there weren't that many of us. So I don't think it was that noticeable.
Right.
And then as the team began to grow, I think it did become more noticeable. And people would have questions, and mm-hmm. they were curious about what was going on. And so we've actually tried to create more and more opportunities for the staff to interact with the students, and we've got a fantastic community manager who's created a lot of these programs. For example, we have a first day meet and greet lunch where we have the whole staff come out and sit down with the new students and just talk to them about what their roles are, what we're working on. We discovered that even though the adult program doesn't connect with the high school program a lot, when the adults found out about it, they were so excited about
it. That's great.
They were so excited. And you can imagine, these are people who are 25 to 45 just discovering their love of technology.
Right.
And this newfound career. And so many of them went through this process, oh, if I had had an opportunity to engage with this when I was 16 years old.
Right.
So we've even had some people who have sponsored high school students created scholarship opportunities for them.
Yeah.
We had a company who created a scholarship fund in honor of one of their former employees who they lost, and one of the adult students who felt like they didn't need it provided that to a high school kid. So, there's just some really amazing community elements that exist across the entire ecosystem.
That's incredible. And can you talk about one question I had from when we were first starting our conversation was, you mentioned that the adult program, people typically 25 to 45, they are starting over. Granted, software development, like you said, well paid, fairly kind of prestigious in the world, but they are getting ready to leave a, white collar job often and restart from the bottom. Do you think that, are they comfortable with that? Is there something happening sort of in society where that's sort of more okay than it would have been to them 10 or 20 years ago, and maybe they would have wanted to just keep grinding it out even if they knew that wasn't going to be what they were interested in, or maybe those career prospects were shrinking? But what is it like for those folks, starting over?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's one woman in particular that I can think of who had a career, had a 9-10 year career in investment banking that she walked away from to do this. So it certainly happens. We have attorneys from large firms who walk away from those careers to do this. So it's certainly happening. I think that our professional environment today is very different than it was even 10 years ago. And I think part of that is the expectations that people have for their career have changed. We were talking about mission-driven versus commercially-driven. I think people, if given the choice, want to love what they do every day.
Yeah.
And I think we also talked a little bit at the beginning of this conversation about creating more access for people into these types of technical careers. If you had to make the choice about changing your career, and it was a 2, 3, or 4 year education commitment and $100,000 to $150,000, you would think twice about doing it. However, if you have experimented with Code Academy and you've tried to learn a little bit of code and you think, wow, I really love this, I'm really into this, which wasn't accessible 5-10 years ago.
Right.
So you've now dabbled in it a little bit, and now you've got a program where you can go spend 12 weeks and gain enough skills to be able to get a foothold into this profession, the cost of doing that is just less in terms of the time in your life, in terms of hard dollars that you're out of pocket, and especially when you have access to an incredible placements team like we have, where we're really going to work to find you the right type of job with the right employer that's a good fit for you. So the risk and reward, I think, is changing as the access to the right kind of education is changing, along with that macro environment where I think people do have a different expectation on what their careers are today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Christy, this has been so wonderful to get your perspective and insight on what you and the team are building at Flatiron School. I know we're out of time. Can you tell listeners how to find out more about Flatiron School?
Absolutely. Go to flatironschool.com, and you can get more information about our adult programs as well as our pre-college programs, and send us an email, give us a call. We'd love to hear from you.
Great. Thanks again.
Good to see you, Rennie.
Thank you for listening to Numbers and Narrative. Classes for both adults and high school students are available through the website flatironschool.com. You can also find Christy on Twitter at Christy Riordan. That's KristiRiordan. You can follow this podcast on iTunes or Podkicker by subscribing to Numbers and Narrative. And also check out our website, numbersandnarrative.com, and follow us on Twitter at Numbers Narrative. Thank you again for listening.
Join us next week when we interview naval historian Steve Ujifusa. This production is co-hosted by Randy McPherson and Joe Flood, with theme music by Matt Morello and produced by me, Quinn Griffin.